It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR and online at www.wrir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegebright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show,
the CDC estimates that 1 in 5 Americans, or 50 million of us, are suffering from a disability. So this is not a narrow definition. A lot of us will fall into these categories. The Fair Housing Law specifically says a disability is someone with a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities. And then it goes on to define some of those elements in that definition. But again, it's very broad.
Helen Hardiman, Director of Fair Housing at Housing Opportunities Made Equal, talks about fair housing rights for people with disabilities. And during this week's News You Can Use, you'll learn about the success Virginia has had with our health insurance marketplace. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 229, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and online at www.wrir.org, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. What do estate attorney Phoebe Hall, disability attorney Charles Crumbine, and employment law attorney Mark Barron all have in common? They've all appeared on WRIR within the past 6 months on this show. No other radio station in Richmond can make that claim. No other radio station offers WRIR's variety of underrepresented news, views, and music. If you like what you hear and want to continue hearing it, please call 622-9747 to make your gift or donate online at www.wrir.org to keep Law for the Rest of Us on Radio for the Rest of Us. Thank you. And now, this week's News You Can Use. There's good news about Virginia's health insurance marketplace. It already has exceeded its enrollment target for this year, signing up nearly 103,000 people. The credit for this success belongs to Virginia's hardworking, under-resourced navigators and application counselors, not the state, which forfeited millions of dollars in federal funding for consumer assistance. Virginia has only a handful of navigators, less than 20, for the 624,000 consumers eligible to buy insurance in the marketplace. They are funded through a federal grant of $1.8 million to help walk consumers through their options in the federal marketplace. While that may seem like a lot of money, it is minuscule compared to what other states have received, and it's not even close to what Virginia had a chance to get. That's because Virginia lawmakers made a critical mistake when they refused to pull in the additional resources available to states that take an active role in consumer assistance. That decision, motivated by the desire of some lawmakers to see health care reform fail, severely limited the resources available to connect consumers with coverage. Virginia could have had 10, perhaps even 20 times as much funding had the state been more engaged. For example, Virginia got $3 per consumer eligible to buy insurance in the marketplace, while Arkansas, which agreed to actively help, received $63 per consumer. It's amazing that the navigators and application counselors have helped so many people with so little, but just think about what could have been if Virginia lawmakers had put their constituents ahead of partisan politics. Meanwhile, the deadline for signing up for health insurance through the marketplace is March 31st, and the penalty for not having health insurance is not capped at $95. It is the maximum of $95 for each uninsured household member or 1% of taxable income. The top penalty could be about $3,600 for an individual and $11,000 for a family of four. The Tax Policy Center, jointly run by the Urban Institute and the Brookings Institution, has an online calculator at www.taxpolicycenter.org. So remember, unless you have a qualifying event, your only chance to buy insurance through the marketplace is during the open enrollment period, which ends March 31st. To contact a local navigator, call 200-6035 or toll free at 888-392-5132. With this week's news you can use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. Legal education is legal empowerment and an essential part of the struggle for fairness, equality, and justice. Since 2005, WRIR has made programs like the Legal Aid Radio Show possible so you can hear what nobody else will broadcast. Whether it's unrepresented news, views, or music, WRIR is the only outlet for cultural diversity in Richmond, and you, our listeners, make it possible. Call 622-9747 to make your gift or donate online at www.wrir.org to keep Law for the Rest of Us on Radio for the Rest of Us. Thank you. We're here at the offices of Housing Opportunities Made Equal in downtown Richmond, and we are speaking today with Helen Hardiman, who is the director of Fair Housing at Home, and we will be talking today about housing discrimination and how it affects people with disabilities. Welcome to the show, Helen.
Thanks for having me, Marty. Good to be here.
Nice to be here. And as an introduction, could you tell our listening audience what are the categories of people who are protected under fair housing law?
Sure. So there are eight protected classes in Virginia, and those are race, color, religion, which includes no religion, national origin, sex or gender, familial status, which is the presence of children under 18 in the home or pregnant women, disability, and then in Virginia, elderliness, which is defined as someone who has reached the age of 55.
Now, what housing practices are considered to be discriminatory and unlawful?
The Fair Housing Act is pretty broad, so anything that really relates to a housing transaction that's based on any of those protected classes is likely to be covered. But the law does name a few practices in particular that are unlawful, including refusing to rent to someone or to show them available housing, imposing different terms and conditions on people because of their membership in one of those protected classes. If a housing provider tells you that a home isn't available, even though maybe you just saw it advertised for rent, discriminatory advertisements in themselves, discriminatory statements are illegal. And then, as we'll talk a bit, for people with disabilities, a refusal to make a reasonable accommodation or modification is also unlawful under fair housing laws.
So we're going to be talking today about housing discrimination against people with disabilities. And what in particular is considered a disability?
The CDC estimates that 1 in 5 Americans, or 50 million of us, are suffering from a disability. So this is not a narrow definition. A lot of us will fall into these categories. The Fair Housing Law specifically says a disability is someone with a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities. And then it goes on to define some of those elements in that definition. But again, it's very broad. Physical or mental impairment includes visual, speech, hearing impairments, epilepsy, autism, developmental delays, emotional illness, cancer, heart disease, HIV, AIDS. It really runs the gamut.
If you have a disability, one of the issues, of course, is accessibility. And I understand that there are accessibility requirements in the fair housing law, but they don't apply to all housing. They only apply to some housing. What type of housing has these accessibility requirements, and how old or new does that housing have to be?
Any new multifamily buildings that were constructed after March of 1991 And when I say multifamily, I mean four or more units. Any dwellings that would fall under that date stamp are required to have various accessible features. And in a four-unit building with an elevator, all of the units in that building have to be accessible. If it's a four-unit building, again, built after 1991, that does not have an elevator, every single ground floor unit has to have these seven features.
And what are those seven features?
Accessible public and common use areas, an accessible entrance on an accessible route, so there can't be stairs outside that would prevent, say, someone with a mobility disability from entering the building. Usable doors, which has to do with the hardware and the weight. An accessible route into and through the dwelling unit. So once you're in the unit, there also can't be stairs preventing someone, say, from a wheelchair from getting into the kitchen. Accessible light switches, electrical outlets, thermostats, and other environmental controls. And this has to do with the height. Reinforced walls in the bathrooms if someone needs to install grab bars. And usable kitchens and bathrooms for someone in a wheelchair. So there has to be enough floor space for someone in a wheelchair to turn around in the bathroom in the kitchen.
Now, earlier you mentioned two terms, and we'll talk about them in order, reasonable modification and reasonable accommodation. Let's start with the first one. What is a reasonable modification?
A reasonable modification is an alteration to the physical premises, allowing someone with a disability to overcome any obstacles that interfere with their ability to fully use and enjoy their unit, the dwelling unit, and or the common areas. So again, we're talking about physical, structural features of a unit. And here, this would be a change that someone with a disability would need to make to their unit in order to use it.
How is that request made? Is that burden entirely upon the person with the disability?
So a person with a disability that wants a reasonable modification to be made to their unit does have the responsibility to ask the housing provider for that modification. They don't have to ask in writing. They can ask verbally. They can ask in person. But as a fellow lawyer, you and I know it's always best to do that in writing, to date and sign and keep a copy of that for yourself.
Now, is the housing provider required to tell people who have disabilities that they do have the right to request a reasonable modification, or is this something that the person with a disability simply needs to find out on their own by contacting your office or the Virginia Fair Housing office or listening to this radio show?
That's a good question. Private housing providers don't have an affirmative duty to notify their tenants that they can request and receive a reasonable modification. But if the person with a disability does request it, the housing provider must grant it as long as the request is reasonable. And that's why Home appreciates opportunities like this to help spread the word about these fair housing rights for people with disabilities. So, well, we hope that people with disabilities know about these rights and can call Home if they need help leveraging those rights.
Now, you mentioned that a private housing provider doesn't have any affirmative obligation to let a person with a disability know of their right to ask for a reasonable modification. What about a public housing agency or a subsidized landlord getting federal or state subsidy? Do they have some burden to let the people with disability know that they can request a reasonable modification?
They do. So there is a distinction between public and private housing on the issue of reasonable modifications and accommodations. Any government subsidized housing should be letting their residents and tenants know that they have these rights. Another distinction between private and public housing is in private housing, if someone wants to make a reasonable modification, they have to pay for that themselves. So if they need to widen the door or install a ramp to get into the unit, they're going to have to pay for that themselves. However, in government subsidized housing, the landlord or the housing provider is going to be required to pay for those modifications.
And does the request for a reasonable modification have to be verified in some manner, maybe by a medical provider or some other type of written verification?
That's a good question. And we get calls from people with disabilities that ask this a lot. How much do I have to disclose to my landlord? And frankly, if your disability is obvious, your landlord cannot ask for verification of that disability. Now, if the modification that you're requesting is not obvious how that connects to your disability, the landlord can ask you to explain that. But if you don't have an obvious disability, the housing provider does have a right to ask for verification from a medical professional. Now, this doesn't have to be a doctor. It can be a social worker. And it doesn't have to be a long, detail-oriented letter about your disability or even disclose your diagnosis. It just has to simply state, I know this person and they have a disability and they have a right to this modification.
Okay, I think that covers reasonable modification. Let's talk about reasonable accommodation. What exactly is a reasonable accommodation?
A reasonable accommodation is a change in the rules or the policies or the practices of a housing provider when that accommodation is necessary for a person with a disability, again, to fully use and enjoy their housing units.
So can you give some examples of what might be considered a reasonable accommodation, changing some rule or policy or something like that?
Sure. So permitting a seeing eye dog for a household in a community where pets are not allowed, or not charging a deposit for a similar service animal for someone with a mental disability, even though the housing provider charges deposits for pets generally. Another example of a reasonable accommodation is requesting an accessible parking space or designing a parking space near a door for a tenant with a disability who can't walk long distances. Permitting a live-in personal care attendant to live with someone with a disability who might need 24-hour assistance, or waiving guest fees or rules due to this need. Final example would be changing the way a housing provider communicates with a tenant, such as increasing the font size of documents for someone with visual impairment, or providing reminders of rent due for someone with a mental disability who needs such reminders.
And we discussed this when we talked about reasonable modification, but again, is the burden on the person with the disability to make that request for the reasonable accommodation? And again, is there any burden on the landlord, be it a public landlord subsidized with some tax dollars or a private landlord, to at least let the person with a disability know that they have this right?
If you have a disability and you need an accommodation, the best thing to do is to put that request in writing to your landlord. So you can have someone make that request on your behalf, but it really the burden in private housing is for the person with a disability to speak up and say, I need this accommodation, basically putting the ball then in the housing provider's court to make the reasonable accommodation or to at least engage in a conversation about how that accommodation can be met.
So as with request for reasonable modification, does the request for a reasonable accommodation, does that have to be verified in some manner?
So Marty, same rule here. If your disability is obvious, the landlord cannot ask for verification of your disability. But again, if it's not clear how the accommodation will alleviate the symptoms of your disability or otherwise allow you to use and enjoy your housing, it's best to explain that to your landlord. And if a medical professional needs to step in to do that, it's good to have them do so as well.
And again, who pays for a reasonable accommodation?
The landlord in public or private housing always pays for the reasonable accommodation unless it's an undue financial burden on that housing provider. And that's a case-by-case determination.
Now, earlier you mentioned service animals, and I wanted to get into that in a bit more detail because there's somewhat of a mythology out there that, you know, this is just a ruse used by people. They just want to have a pet in violation of the no pet policy, and so they claim they need a service animal, and it's really not true. Would you like to more or less dispel that myth?
I would. You know, I'll just say first, very directly, a service animal is not a pet. It's an animal that works or provides assistance or performs tasks for the benefit of a person with a disability, including providing emotional support that alleviates identified symptoms or effects of that disability. These are very real relationships that provide real benefit to people with disabilities, and service animals, whether it's a dog or a bird, you know, whatever that person with a disability needs, if they can prove that that animal is because of their disability and alleviates the symptoms of those disabilities, they have a right to have that under the Act.
And I imagine that verification requirements here are somewhat stringent. How would someone demonstrate that this service animal really is needed?
So, Marty, same process here if it's a service animal. You can get a medical provider to document the disability-related need for that animal. And I also want to say that under the Fair Housing Act, the animal does not have to be individually trained or certified. You just need a medical professional to say that this person has a disability and they need this animal.
And I guess the last thing I wanted to talk about, and this is becoming an increasing problem, especially with an aging population, has to do with hoarding. First of all, what is hoarding?
Sure. Hoarding is a mental health disorder that involves acquiring and keeping objects, which results in a home that's pretty cluttered and can actually cause the resident distress, and it might be difficult or dangerous to live there.
So what type of reasonable accommodation does a landlord have to grant if someone is in fact a hoarder and a request is made for the accommodation?
The most common reasonable accommodation that we see in cases of people suffering from hoarding are either to stop an eviction and to ask for more time basically to clean the premises. So if it is a threat to the health and safety of the tenant or of neighbors, that is a problem. But again, as an accommodation, if the reason for the clutter is because of a person's disability, they can ask for a reasonable accommodation to address that.
So it sounds like a lot of these rights are out there, but people with disabilities really need to be aware of them and to request them. So as my last question is, where can and should people go for help?
Well, I hope they will come to home. Our fair housing services are free and they are statewide. And anyone that has a question about their fair housing rights, including if someone with a disability wants help writing a reasonable accommodation or reasonable modification letter, or if they've done so and have been denied by their landlord, they can call home and ask for a fair housing specialist, and we will do everything we can to help. Our phone number is 804-354-0641, and our website is www.homeofva.org.
Well, thank you very much. We have been talking with Helen Hardiman. She is the Director of Fair Housing at Housing Opportunities Made Equal of Virginia, or as commonly known, HOME. Thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure.
Remember when radio used to be real people spinning real records? Remember when news and talk programs used to be insightful and relevant? We at WRIR do too. WRIR DJs hand select the music they play each week. WRIR also features locally produced news and talk covering local, national, and international stories. We are Richmond Independent Radio, radio for the rest of us, and you, our listeners, make it possible. Call 622-9747 to make your gift, or donate online at www.wrir.org. Thank you. That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Credit card defenses, nursing home abuses, tax tips for your year 2013 filing. You won't be informed about these issues anywhere other than on this radio station, WRIR. If you want to continue hearing law you need to know to avoid getting ripped off, please call 622-9747 to make your gift, or donate online at www.wrir.org to keep Law for the Rest of Us on Radio for the Rest of Us. Richmonders Involved to Strengthen Our Communities, or RISC, has stood against injustice for 12 years. Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when speakers at the March 17 RISC rally talk about affordable housing and affordable health care training for the Nehemiah Action on April 7 at 7 p.m. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegwright.